My God.
This is Reel 7, September 19th, 1971. Ray, you have a further episode in the life of Harry Fleischer.
Well, yes, episodes, really. There are many connected with his life. He he was very adept at ducking the police when the police wanted him very much. I remember that during the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, some of the geniuses in the East who were working on the case, and actually a lot of the police who were involved in that were very incompetent. I saw them in action, but they had heard something about the Detroit Purple Gang, so they made Harry Fleischer a suspect in the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby. Of course, those of us who knew him and his associates knew that they just weren't capable of doing anything like that. It would never entered their mind they wouldn't kidnap anyone, let alone a child, a baby. However, he made himself very scarce at that time. He wasn't around, just to save himself the trouble of being arrested, I suppose, and questioned. But another time, he was being sought because the Supreme Court had upheld his conviction in the holdup of this aristocrat club, this gambling place in Pontiac, that we talked about, and for which he was sentenced to a long term in prison. And whether he got advance word and what the Supreme Court was going to do or not, I don't know. But when the police went to pick him up, he was gone. And he stayed gone for a long time while they were looking for him. It developed that he was arrested during that time, he was on the lam, by the Cincinnati police. He was living in Cincinnati and taken to the police station. He was arrested on a traffic violation, but taken to the police station. And before they could do much about his fingerprints, he talked to them real earnestly and convinced them that he was a longtime resident of Cincinnati, that his wife was going to have a baby any minute. And he had to be released to get home to her so he could take her to the hospital because she was in very delicate condition. So the police released him and didn't know what they had, because flyers had gone all over the country about him, because he was a fugitive. The FBI was looking for him, everybody was, so they could put him in Jackson Prison. The Cincinnati police released him, and I don't think they drove him home, but they practically did everything else, because they felt so sorry for a man who was so upset because his wife was going to have a baby. I don't think that Harry was married even at that time. He was living alone in Cincinnati, at least. I had to go to, I wrote quite a bit about that in the Times, and kidding the Cincinnati police in a way that made them look kind of bad. Well, they did look bad in the thing. They didn't check the guy out. So, right after that, while the story, the ink was almost still dry in the papers, I had to go to Cincinnati on a murder story and deal with the police. And when I walked in, I wasn't the most welcome person in that police station, because they'd been reading the stories I'd been writing about them. However, it didn't take long to get along with them. There are a good bunch of fellas down there, and we all laughed about it, really. Fleischer was picked up later and served his time. I think that's the only... his arrest in Cincinnati was in 49, and he was with in Cincinnati while he was living alone. It was later developed that he was with Johnny Gotch, who was known as Jiggy Jiggy Johnny, and who was one of the best, with a reputation at least, of being one of the most competent burglars that Detroit ever produced, and that says a lot. Gotch made a specialty of finding out, in those years there was still a lot of hot money around, people who were cheating on their income tax and would keep cash, either in their saloons or nightclubs or blind pigs or gambling establishments, their homes, and, or they might be legitimate people, you know, so-called legitimate, except for the income tax, professional people, doctors, lawyers, whatever. And he made it a practice to find out about those people and burglarize. And there are places, and of course, they were very reluctant to report it. But a lot of us knew some of the scores he made in those burglaries, and they were $50,000, $60,000. And Johnny would spend it about as fast as he'd get it, so he had to keep working. He met a sudden and tragic ending. He was burglarizing one place on a Sunday afternoon, and something he didn't know, the man who had the hidden money in his house, this was the house he was burglarizing, heard him trying to get in through the front door and shot him to death with a shotgun. This was in the very early 50s, and this ended up quite an interesting career of Johnny Gotch. There was a colony of these fellows who were convicted, and they stayed by themselves pretty well in Jackson. Jackson Prison, I used to see them when I go up there. Mike Selleck, they're all convicted in the Pontiac Aristocrat Club thing, if it ever was robbed. I was sad, maybe I said it before, but I was sad that, to me it was always ridiculous, because Harry Fleischer, with his reputation, could have held that place up by telephone. In other words, he could have called them up, the Aristocrat Club, and told them to bring their money down to him in Detroit, and they would, because he was pretty generally feared, and he was a pretty tough guy. But up at prison, there was Fleischer and Mike Selleck, who was convicted in that charge, and he also took it on the lam. He wasn't found for quite a while, and then he was found in a burglary in New York in one of the big hotels there. He was arrested and sent back to Detroit. And Pete Mahoney was a Detroit gambler, and a gambler only. He certainly was not a hold-up man. Many of us were very skeptical of the effort to convict of these people, but they nevertheless served the time. They probably rationalized that they owed the state that much time for other crimes anyway. So, when I see them at Jackson, they didn't seem to be doing a very hard time. They seemed to be getting along well, and were kind of the inmate bosses up there. Did I put down about
it? Right, didn't he work in the greenhouses there, Jackson, when we went to visit?
You're thinking of Pete Mahoney.
Oh, where was Fleischer? Didn't I see him in the kitchen there?
Yeah.
Hmm?
Yes. Fleischer's previous prison term was in a federal penitentiary where he served most of 5 years for counterfeiting. That was about in the mid-30s. How the hell could that have been in the mid-30s?
We're talking, Ray, about the Joanne Gillespie murder. The spelling is J-O capital A-N-N, Gillespie.
Yes, this was an 18-year-old girl who lived on Fisher Avenue on the east side of Detroit. And on the night of January 2nd, 1953, she and a girlfriend had gone to the Deluxe Motion Picture Theater on Kercheval near Hamilton. Near Parkview, pardon me. The girls, after the movie, the girls went their separate ways and arranged to telephone each other when they arrived home to report they'd gotten home safely. Julianne never got home. Someplace on Fisher Avenue, a man jumped from the bushes, dragged her between houses, and choked her and beat her over the head, and apparently attempted to rape her, but didn't get very far beyond disarranging some of her clothes when a couple of people in the neighborhood heard some commotion and turned their lights on, and he ran. The girl, however, was dead from the blow on the head, which was believed to be a heavy limb from a tree that had fallen down. Now, hundreds of people were questioned in connection with this murder, which shook Detroit, really, and was played very big in the newspapers. But there wasn't a clue. In those days, the police used to just round up people, bring them in, hold them for investigation, question them, put them on the polygraph, and if they couldn't connect them, turn them out again, let them go. There didn't have to be any charges. They were arrested for investigation of her murder. But nothing turned up. Many times they thought they had the right person, only proved wrong. 4 years later, a man who was an ex-Marine named Philip Singer, who lived in that neighborhood and who was well known in the bars there as a quiet, happy beer drinker. He worked in a linen supply company and was unmarried, lived in a rooming house, was urinating on the sidewalk, and two police arrested him. They asked him who he was. He gave his name. They said, "Where do you live?" And he said, "I live across the street." This was 4 years after she was killed. "I live across the street from where Joanne Gillespie was killed." They immediately thought, well, he did it. Because actually, the case was still open and police were still working on that murder. Not full time, but part time. So they took him down to the homicide squad. Two detectives were assigned to the case and began questioning him. Later came out he was hit once, threatened, was given a lie detector test, which the head of the homicide squad said was proof positive that he was lying when he denied that he killed the girl, which he did at first, after he got down to homicide. Well, after a couple of days of questioning and threats and suggestions, he said, yes, he did kill her. And then he gave something of a detailed confession. But before the confession, regarding the polygraph, man who was in charge of the homicide squad said it was the most startling polygraph test I've ever seen. When we asked him about the offense for which he was arrested, he answered, it showed a straight line. When we asked him if he killed Joanne, the line jumped all over. We showed him the results. We showed him he had lied about having been in a hotel with another woman that night, is what he had told him. Sure, he lied about that. Finally, he said, yes, I did it. I want to tell you all about it. Then we put him on the polygraph again. When he asked him about Joanne, he said, yes, he killed her. And the polygraph showed a straight line again. This, of course, is another of the many instances I've seen of a polygraph test being completely unreliable. It's called a lie detector. It does not detect a lie. It rarely works. I've seen so many people beat it one way or the other. Now, in this case, it victimized this man. They then questioned him, and he said that he had followed Joanne Gillespie that night as she was going up Fisher, going north on Fisher, and he jumped out and grabbed her by the throat and the waist and pulled her between houses. And in the darkness, he groped around and found a stone or a brick or a chunk of concrete. Now, this is what he said. And it fit in his hand, and with that, he battered the girl's head. Now, the police up to this point had been maintaining that a part of a tree was the lethal weapon that he had found there, because they did find, the night they recovered her body, a club-like tree trunk, and they decided that was the murder weapon. Never had they said anything before in the 4 years about a brick or a stone or a piece of concrete. But at any rate, he didn't know that, so he supplied the weapon, battered her head. He said he fooled around with her. She was dying and disarranged her clothes. But abruptly, according to his confession, he went into a panic and ran away. He walked to his car and drove around for a while. And at last, and later, he went to a hotel and stayed about 3 hours. He said he had not known Joanne Gillespie. And he couldn't offer any reason for the sudden attack. The newspapers got calls after this so-called confession, or confession, was printed, and from many of his friends who said he was a mild-mannered man incapable of murder, incapable of hurting anyone. He was well-liked. He lived, as I say, in a rooming house, and his only vice was drinking beer and going with girls to an occasional hotel. He was arraigned and put in the county jail. I printed his confession when it was released by the police, and I talked to him at the same time, and he said, yes, the confession was true, that's the way it happened. So, after he was in the county jail a couple of days, after being arraigned and charged with murder, I went over to see him, and there was a little doubt in my mind by this time that he had killed her. I think the doubt was born of the fact that he was a mild sort of person. And I had talked to a lot of people in the neighborhood who knew him, and from hearing what they had to say about him, also his employers, that he was a kindly person, who, as I say, would hurt no one, but was always doing things for people. And I didn't let him know that I had any doubt about his confession at all. And he went on and told me the same story over again. So I went back in another, like 4 or 5 days, and he still told me he did it. Hadn't changed his story, but I could see something happening to him. It was quite obvious his appearance was changing because he was getting the alcohol out of his system. He was a man who drank a lot every day. And there was a physical change in him. His skin cleared up, and he'd have a little blow that went away. And mentally, he was more alert. So I left, and I came back in about a week, and just visit him again. And he said, you know, I didn't kill that girl. And I acted as if this was indeed a great surprise to me, and I said, well, how do you know that? He said, hell, I know where I was that night. He said, I was so confused when the police told me I did it. And they told me that lie detector couldn't be wrong, and it showed I did it. Therefore, I believed when I told him that I had done it. But then during the questioning, I thought, no, I didn't, but they keep insisting that I had done it, and that machine that they put me on, they told me, said I did it, so I must have had it, must have killed her and not remembered it. But he said, I know now that I didn't. My mind is clear. He'd then been in jail a couple of weeks or so without anything to drink. And he said, I know what I did that night. I did what I told him I did. I was in such and such a hotel on Jefferson. It's a small hotel out there in that neighborhood. And I was with this girl, and he named her, gave me her address. He said they won't believe me, but that's the truth. I didn't kill Miss Gillespie or anybody else. I went to see the girl, and she backed up what he said completely, that she'd been with him all that time. Now, she was a waitress someplace, but she did have a reputation, and I thought it was kind of noble of her to say that she'd been sleeping with him when she knew it eventually would get in the paper. She said she'd testify if he went to trial. I had gone to see his attorney previously, and I got feeling this man was innocent. I got kind of a shock when I went in his office, the attorney's office. He was a court-appointed attorney, by the way, because Singer had no money. The first thing I saw was a big picture of Herbert Hoover in his office. And then when I talked to him, he seemed very stuffy. And I thought, and it came out that he had never, in his long career as a lawyer, he was in his late 50s, maybe 60, that he had never tried a criminal case. And that he wanted to try one. He asked for this assignment so that he could end his legal career. He's going to retire after that, having tried one case. And I thought, oh, God, help Singer. He'll never survive the trial, even though I think he's completely guilty. This man knows nothing about the jungle at his recorder's court, knows nothing about the tactics that are used, knows nothing about the way the police are going to testify, because they were convinced that by this time, they had some of them, The ones that were on the case were convinced that he'd done it. And this man might be a fine guy for to be a corporation attorney, but he doesn't know anything about this law. And the result, usually, is that the client goes to prison when he has this kind of legal service. I say usually. In my experience, it's been that way. But he was kind of a guy I couldn't get very close to and didn't really want to because I didn't know what were a lot of things I could have told him that would have helped him. But I didn't want to get involved that way at that time because I thought he might be, making a speech like that night saying I had told him so and so and so and so. And all during the trial, as a matter of fact, I kept sort of arm's length from the guy. It was amazing to see him field work, however. The papers kept playing up the confession during the trial, and Singer, when it was the defense's, or the police that testified to it, there wasn't much else. Let's see, there wasn't anything else besides his confession and the fact that the girl was dead and that he lived in that neighborhood and that he was exposing himself. They choose to call it that. Actually, he was urinating. But they made it sound like a sex offense. And he had been in, by the way, here's just one example I recall of the testimony. One of the detectives on the case said that, he knew that Singer told him that he'd been in World War II with the Marines, which he had been. And he got shot in the tail, implying, of course, that he was, the detective witness implied that he was running away. On cross-examination, Phil brought out that the detective had never been in the service, but that it was a lot of people who were going forward were hit in the back from flying shrapnel and other shells. But I mean, even that little rotten detail, I tried to set this man up. It came the defense's time to have time to put the defense in. And the attorney, Leslie Field, called Singer to the stand. And he's probably the worst witness I've ever heard in my life. He did everything to make himself look bad and answered every question wrong. Could have answered them better, but he just seemed weak. He sounded, Mary, you were there. He sounded guilty, everything he said. They took a recess during his trial, and they put him back in the bullpen. And I went back to him and said, for Christ's sake, I never heard a guy like this. Are you doing, do you want to go to Jackson Prison for life? Is this what? And I tried to tell him to answer questions properly without, telling me, I kept emphasizing, tell the truth because you say you didn't do it, and make it out that way. He went back on the stand and continued in the same vein, and I thought he didn't have a chance of being acquitted after his own testimony. Phil, however, brought the police in when they showed that one of them had hit him, that he threats had been made, that he didn't have an attorney. He was never told of his constitutional rights. Of course, no one in those days was told that unless he was affluent enough to have an attorney before he was questioned, he showed the failures of the police to make any kind of a thorough investigation regarding Singer. And eventually, the trial went on almost 10 days. Oh, the girl who told me she was with him came in and testified. And that she had slept with him. And laid her reputation right on the line. And she was very convincing. And it appeared she was convincing the jury. That is, I thought she was at the time, but then I thought, no, he's still gone. You know, he can't overcome this thing. The jury went out, and they were out 2 or 3 hours, and came back with a not guilty verdict. And it's one time, I guess, in the story that I was a little bit, well, I've been emotionally involved several times, but I was sorry for this guy because I just knew he didn't do it. And a certain policeman, no longer there, who put out of the homicide shortly after that and left the department not too long later, was just dying to get the Joanne Gillespie case cleared up so he could take credit for it, and who allegedly said to a fellow officer, the next guy who comes in and confesses that thing is gonna go. I'm sick of these phony confessions, because every murder that was played up big in the papers would draw mentally unbalanced people who would come in and want to confess. And I spent an awful lot of time disproving confessions. And this, I guess, was another one, although he knew after his brain cleared. He had the alcoholics call a wet brain. And it cleared, however, when he was away from the liquor, and he became a different person. Much sharper, but still a terrible witness. He was freed. The murder's not been solved. I'm positive he didn't do it. So is everybody connected with the case now. Some of the homicide officers testified that two of them, and they weren't, the others wouldn't speak to them for a long time after that, but they had searched his room when they were out in the neighborhood, and they were looking all over every place, and there was no mud on his shoes, there was no evidence of anything. Although, to go between the houses that night, it was a rainy night, there'd have to be mud. His clothes would have to show something. It was the same clothes that they found. And there was no physical evidence at all. He was acquitted, and there was one time that I was very surprised, really, that justice was done to a poor, friendless, harmless sort of guy. There's one ironic twist to it. The girl who testified that she slept with him that night waited during the rest of, to hear the rest of the trial. Before he was arrested, he had taken up with another gal who was there every day. When the trial was over and he walked out a free man, he walked out arm in arm with this new girl he had taken up and left the other one standing all by herself in the corridor. Not even saying thanks, goodbye.
But that's
sad. Yeah, remember that? It was a sad thing. I think he was just, he probably didn't even see her, I don't know. But if he should have, if there's anything a person should have seen, it should have been that girl who was pretty much responsible for his acquittal. Here's one thing that I recall distinctly. Again, the lie detector polygraph was wrong many, many, many times, and I can't say it enough. You gotta keep repeating it.
Was there any reference in the course of the trial to the wiretap?
No. Couldn't have correctly referred to in the trial. But it...
How did Singer explain the fact that he did confess?
Oh, he said that the... Yes, there was a reference. He said that they bullied him into it, and that he... and that they told him this machine they put him on showed that he was lying when he said he didn't kill her. Therefore, he thought, and he never heard of why it didn't occur in his life. He was a guy with a pretty limited person. And he thought that because that's what it was supposed to have shown, that he did it.
His attorney came to a rather tragic end not long afterwards.
Yeah, it was tragic. I came to admire Mr. Fields greatly because of his great skill and dedication to this case and his intelligence. He tried a terrific lawsuit. I was quite wrong in my first appraisal of him. And incidentally, making inquiries about him, I found that the picture of Hoover was sort of a gag on his part, that actually he was quite a liberal man. He was at the University Hospital undergoing some treatment in Ann Arbor, and he committed suicide. Now, I don't know whether they had told him that he had something that was incurable or why.
His wife had shortly before that. He didn't
show any depression, right? So immediately when his wife, who was at home in the East Side Indian Village, in her home, heard about it, she went out in the garage and hanged herself. So the two of them were killed. It was after honey when she had heard it, yeah.
Excuse me.
It's all right. I want you.
You said in there when you were talking to Field, you were convinced of the man's guilt. You meant innocence. And that's on it.
I said what?
This is September 30, 1971. Ray, we're going to go through the September 26th feature piece by Joe Wolfe on the Collingwood massacre and raise those points that strike you as either incorrect or questionable.
Yeah, I'll start at the beginning. The lead in the story is that Detroit was quiet. The hoodlums and guerrillas and muscle men and so on were in hiding. I have no idea what that's based on. My recollection is it was business as usual. And from Grosse Pointe to Wyandotte, I've never known it during Prohibition to be quiet in all that territory. The exact date we've got to get of the shooting on Collingwood.
We have that, I think, Ray, on the back of the police photo.
Oh, I see. All right. Because in paragraph 2, I'm not sure just what he means. Harry Toy, Wayne County prosecutor, was always issuing orders for roundups, and it didn't mean too much. They'd just be picked up and released again. Now, it was never, to my knowledge, the victims, to my knowledge, were never called the Little Third Avenue Navy. It was a little Navy gang. And it was limited to about those three, the three who were killed. Capone was not kept out of Detroit because he was afraid of anybody here. But he had all he could handle over in Chicago, and Ennis and Byron's had enough business over there. That was where he made his money, any more than he took over New York or Chicago Philadelphia. These men were the victims, and I'm going right down the line in this story. It says, were brought to Detroit from Chicago in 26 by leaders of the Oakland Sugar House Gang. The Oakland Sugar House was the Purple Gang. As kids, they used to hang out there. And before anybody hung the name Purple Gang on them, they were referred to as the Sugar House Gang or the Oakland Sugar House Gang. They'd hardly be bringing in people to hired killers. And I'm not sure just what that means, but I am sure that the Purples didn't bring the Little Navy to Detroit. Now, the Little Navy Gang, as I recall it, did many things. They sold alcohol, they were in gambling, they were in extortion, they were in holdups, they were in shakedowns, but the Navy didn't refer, as many people think, and you've got the impression here, to the Detroit River. They didn't run the river, to my knowledge. This was done by, and the Purples didn't do much river running. All these people were busy making the stuff, both distilling whiskey and making beer in Detroit, where it's environs and running it, not importing it, and making labels and getting the bottles and the sugar and making, you know, putting it all together here. The bottle looked like Canadian liquor. You couldn't tell by looking at it, but it was made here. There was always trouble brewing. All during Prohibition, there were shootings and beatings and a lot of trouble among gangsters. So there was nothing usual at that time. In the Depression, he mentioned stricter law enforcement. There's never strict law enforcement in Prohibition. But racketeers feuded among themselves from time to time, almost endlessly. You know, some big, some little. I guess he means that they hijacked from Friend of Four. I guess that means that the Little Navy was doing this. Well, they were doing about everything. However, that didn't have much to do with their shooting. This whole story of their shooting, a song of being told it at the time, and it was accepted at the time, and they were convicted, three of four who were originally accused, Purple gangsters, were convicted. And the testimony of Sawyer Levine, who said that the trouble was that the Little Navy Gang had bought a large amount of alcohol from the Purples before the American Legion Convention in Detroit to supply the conventioners and the bars who served them, and that they just wouldn't pay for it.
Ray, would 50 gallons, the figure given by Wolf, be too low?
Be way too low. Yeah, be way too low. And, but the amount, I don't recall that any amount was named, but it was a large amount. And the Purples were certainly capable of producing a large amount. They had facilities and sources. But the one thing that's important here is that they bought it, used it for the American Legion, and the convention was long over when this Collingwood massacre took place. And the reason for it was that they just wouldn't pay for it, according to Levine during the trial. Suddenly a series of hijackings didn't begin. I hate to be so positive with this, but there were always hijackings. And these fellows were not hijacking anything from the Purple Gang or that had been killed long before. This was the kind of thing that they tried to work out ahead of time, I mean, tried to collect the money for, and failing in that, they just killed them.
Ray, was it common to extend credit on bootleg sales?
Among people who had established credit, yes. Among dealers who, knew each other and knew that their one's word was good. But whether the Little Navy and the Purples had any such arrangement of a credit arrangement over a period of time, I don't know. It would be possible. It would be quite possible that they could work out a deal on credit for a large amount of alcohol. Incidentally, this thing about the Eastside Mafia had been giving their handbook a big play, and in late August had put over a parlay worth several hundred dollars. Well, even in those years of the Depression, a several hundred dollar parlay wasn't a big deal for a handbook. And this one in Selden wrote a check. I'm not sure whether Levine was in business with the Little Navy in that handbook on Selden around 2nd. But that's where he was arrested just a few hours after the murder by a detective and the homicide whose last name was McMillan. I think his first name was Bill, and I'm not sure. He was a detective sergeant in the homicide.
Thank you, Dr. Speedy.